Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. Now, anyone like me who's watched the Mission Impossible series is familiar with the full mask disguise. It's almost like in Scooby-Doo where they rip it off and say, oh, it's, you know, Joe the Farmer. We see a lot of tricks in disguise in spy movies, many of them ridiculous, like the furniture disguises in Spy Hard or even some of James Bond's gadgets. And in film, it's okay. It's fantasy, and they use certain latitude, squishy reality, if you will, to advance the story and keep us entertained. Most of you, however, are also familiar with the phrase, art imitates life. That phrase came to mind several times when I sat down to read the book, The Moscow Rules, The Secret CIA Tactics That Helped America Win the Cold War. The book is written by Antonio and Jonna Mendez, legends within the spy community. If the name Tony Mendez sounds familiar, it may be because of the movie named Argo, the Academy Award-winning film that depicted the audacious, improbable, and highly risky plan designed and executed by Tony to rescue several American diplomats in the heat of the Iranian Revolution. Art does imitate life. Imagine my surprise upon reading the Moscow Rules that the full face mask depicted in Mission Impossible did actually exist and were actually used. Joining us today, we're very pleased to have the co-author of the Moscow Rules, Jonna Mendez, served over a quarter of a century with the CIA, much of it with the job title Master of Disguise. Jonna, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Ben gets dumb questions, makes dumb mistakes, so let's be clear. Is it Jonna or Jonna?
It's Jonna. I was the last of a family of 13 kids, and they all had girls. I was supposed to be the boy that carried on the family name, so they just put an A on the end of it, and here I am.
13 girls. Wow, that's quite a handful.
Really?
Jonna, first off, my condolences, and we'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
Your book, I love it. But your background... Okay, so we've had hundreds of persons on the show who signed up to support our country in the service, but you took somewhat of a unique path. Jonna, you decided to lie for a living. Is that an accurate?
Well, it was part of the job description. It was. We were lying occasionally, but it was legal when we did it.
Oh, yeah, legal in the spy world. Okay, I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around that. But again, I encourage folks to read the book, The Moscow Rules. It really is interesting. And the title, Jonna, actually is drawn from an actual set of rules or maybe guidelines developed over time through trial and error or observation. It begins with rule number one, Murphy is right, and then goes from there. In the movies, Jonna, things always seem very well planned out and controlled, but it's not quite that way in real life, is it?
You always attempt for planned out and well controlled, but when you have the KGB on your heels, when you have them stalking you through the city, following you in cars, listening to you in the walls, and sitting next to you in your own embassy in the form of local nationals that are working there, it's sometimes hard to keep everything in its channel, in its lane, and going forward as you had planned. You always end up deviating, you're planning on the fly. You have to be flexible. That's one of the things we look for when we hire people.
Sure.
Flexible problem solvers.
Right, to adapt and overcome.
Yeah.
Jonna, now I saw an interview where you described spy movies as quote, historically incorrect but wildly entertaining. One of the themes that runs through this book that I found fascinating, and anybody who's seen the movie Argo or read the book probably gets a hint of this, but the extent to which Hollywood personnel, even magicians, might have been or continue to still be one of the CIA's greatest assets. And that theme runs throughout this book. I talk about the Mission Impossible mask. Jonna, one thing you said was really interesting to me is you said many of these folks that were engaged were never paid. They did it because that was their contribution to our country? Or tell us a little bit more about that.
There were a lot of forward-leaning people out in L.A. that I think were almost flattered to be asked to help when it came to national security. When they learned that their skills or maybe their technology could be useful to the intelligence community. I don't recall anyone ever saying no. And to varying degrees, we would take what they were doing and rework it for our purpose. With a lot of the disguise materials, of course, they're working with lights, and they can shoot a scene 20 times, and they can take 10 hours to put on the makeup and another 5 to take it off. We never had any of those things. We were always looking for something quick on, for something that would absolutely work. There were no second takes, and something that we could remove in one piece and stick in under our arm. So our goals were radically different, actually, but the technologies that allowed us both to succeed, both Hollywood and the intelligence community, those technologies were pretty stable, and they worked on both sides of that line.
Jonna, one of the things that I find fascinating is one of the, and I use the air quotes, technologies that you used, not just in Moscow, but around the world, the CIA used, is maybe as old as time, and that's magic. Some of the basic principles of sleight of hand and deception. And one of the fascinating things I saw in the book was about how you were literally bringing in magicians into the headquarters or your secret, you know, lair in plain sight there, to demonstrate this and to fool. In fact, there's a great little passage in the book where you talk about the magicians, like, okay, look for your, you know, he's there in the office, and look for your wallets. Oh, our wallets are gone. Look for your belt. Oh, our belts are gone. And they had no idea how he pulled this off.
Yeah, that was a very fun moment. That was out in Hollywood. I had taken one of my bosses, who had never been exposed to this group of people, and a contractor. It was a group of about 5 of us, and we walked into a warehouse where they were trying out a new act. And this was a couple that you would see in Las Vegas. This is a couple that you would see on TV. These were very famous performers. And this particular moment, they were flying. She was flying around him, and we were watching. And you could understand, because you could see the apparatus. You could see how it worked. And then when they came down from this pedestal they were on, walked over, they were introduced to us. We were people from Washington. That's all they said. And they, you know, talked to us for just a moment. And these two people walked off. And the magician came over and said, "Now," he said, I want you to check your pockets, check your wrists, check your belts." And I mean, all this stuff was gone. While they had spoken to us, they had a belt, they had a couple of watches, they had a couple of wallets. Of course, they just put them in a pile over in a corner and they left. They were just showing off their skills. It was like something out of Charles Dickens, you know. It was amazing.
Well, and that's when we come back after the break, John, I want to talk about that, because that's another theme that I see through the book, is you've got a very talented and out of the box thinking team that's constantly evolving, and you're adding members of the team and getting feedback from people outside of the agency, if you will. But very often, some of the stuff that your shop came up with was just so outrageous sounding that the bosses were a little bit skeptical. And when we come back, I want to come back to this full face mask thing, because that received a very interesting audition, if you will, in a big house called the White House. So when we come back, I want you to share that a little bit. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Jonna Mendez. She's the co-author of the book Moscow Rules. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking with our second spy of the month, I guess, Jonna Mendez. She's one of the co-authors of just a fabulous book called The Moscow Rules. Jonna, how does one earn the title Master of Disguise? Did that title exist before you had it, or did someone just make that up? Tony, maybe.
You know, it did not exist until it was bestowed on Tony. You earn it, I don't know, you earn it with a little bit of public acclaim. Inside of the CIA, nobody was called the Master of Disguise. But when Tony wrote his first book, he became the Master of Disguise. And in fact, he led that organization for 10 years before I showed up. Then I led it. I was the number 2. And in Tony's passing, people have started calling me the Master of Disguise, and I have not corrected them. I kind of like it.
Fair enough. I would say you've earned it. Now, Jonna, I I opened up the show by just my amazement at these what I call the Mission Impossible face masks, and maybe it's not as literal and not as clear as it is in the film or the TV series, but you, working with the folks in Hollywood, developed something very approximate to this, and you gave it a rather intriguing audition, as I understand it, a little visit to the White House.
You know, we worked on making that mask for over 10 years, and we started out with Hollywood's guidance, but we were making something that they were not. We took the idea to the left. They took it to the right for movies. When Hollywood came in and looked at our finished piece, when they saw our animated mask that you could wear and have a conversation with anybody, they were stunned. They were also stunned that it went on instantly and it came off. Instantly. So you could put it on in a parking garage in the dark and get out of the car and you'd know it was good. And if you needed to, if you were on the run, you could take it off just as quickly and, you know, stuff it under a rock if you had to. The first mask that was made for me was an African American male mask, and it was fabulous. It just looked great. I had gloves to go with it. I showed it to my boss. We ended up showing it to Bill Webster, who was the head of CIA back then. He had been the chief of FBI. Now he was the chief of CIA. And he said, well, take this to the White House. And I said, oh, no, I can't really carry it off. It looks good, but I can't talk like a man. I can't. No, this is too much. He said, well, then make another one. Make one that you can take and wear and model and he won't know. This was for President George H.W. Bush. So we did. We made a second one. One of the girls in my office who was leaving gave me, basically donated her face. I looked just like Becky. I had a wonderful hairdo. I really liked the way I looked in this mask. And when I retired, I wanted to keep it, but of course they said no. Anyway, we went to the White House. I told the judge, Judge Webster, I have no identification. I don't have a piece of paper. He said, don't worry, just hang on to my coattails. And back then, that's all you needed. We walked in and we were waiting outside of the Oval Office because there was a meeting going on ahead of us. And it was awkward. There's a little paranoia when you are first taking something like this out for a test drive. And we normally don't do it at the White House in the Oval Office, but we did. So we went in, we sat in a horseshoe in front of his desk, a group of us, about eight of us. And I was the first one to present. I had taken pictures of President Bush when he was at CIA, when he was in disguise. I said, you will remember these moments. I'm here to show you how far we've come since then. I'm going to show you the best new disguise we have. And he said, well, where is it? And I said, I'm wearing it. And he looked up. And I think he started figuring it out. He was a little more savvy than most CEOs. He said, well, you're going to show it to me? I'll take it off. He said, no, don't take it off. He got up. He walked around from behind, from the side. He's looking. He's went back, sat down, said, okay, take it off. So I did. This was the Tom Cruise peel before Tom Cruise ever thought of it. Peeled off my face. And there was a photographer in the room going around taking pictures. I imagine she's always in there or he's in there documenting these meetings. Next to me was a man named John Sununu, who almost fell out of his chair because he hadn't been paying attention. He was going to speak next. He's working on his notes. Next to him was Brent Scowcroft, who was just squinting at me like, what? What are you doing? Next to him was Bob Gates. I mean, it was a room full of luminaries. And it was quite a moment. It was, I'd say, very successful. My husband had been in the Oval Office years earlier. He said, make sure you know which door you come in because there are other doors, and some of them are broom closets. And he had always heard this story of someone leaving the Oval Office and walking into the broom closet. So I got out of there, went and played with some of Millie's puppies out in the outer office. And the White House photographer came out and said, what was that? What did you just do? And I said, I thought you photographed it. She said, well, I did. but what was that? And I said, well, I can't talk about it. It's classified. So maybe I ticked her off. It took 10 years to get the photo.
But you have those photos. Are they in the public sphere, Jonna, or that?
Oddly, all of this is in the public sphere. If we were having this conversation 2 years ago, we would not be talking about masks at all, you and I, or me and anybody. We didn't mention them. It was off limits. And then it was on limits. I don't know what happened that allowed them to be publicly discussed. It means to me that they're no longer classified. That means to me that they're no longer doing exactly that. But they've changed it in such a way that there's nothing revealed by talking about it now.
Sure, sure. Now, one thing, you know, we talk about exotic things like wearing a disguise into the Oval Office, but one of the learning lessons for me from your book was that your goal was not the James Bond. You know, if everybody knows you're a spy and what you drink and what kind of, you know, weapon you carry, that's not a very good spy. So often your goal was to be, as you call it, the little gray man. You wanted to
Absolutely.
Be somebody who is so innocuous that nobody would give you a second look. Is that?
Yeah.
And part of the reason for that is, again, we're focusing on Moscow principally in this book and your actions there. The minute, well, A, there were spies all throughout the embassy, from maids to gardeners to typists. But the minute right. any of your personnel left that front gate, immediately they had a tail, right?
They did. We had teams. We had dedicated teams that followed us who were familiar with our vehicles, the stores we'd go to, the routes we would take. They knew on Tuesdays we did this and on Thursdays we did that. They were our surveillance teams. And they would almost smother you in this embrace because their goal was to keep you from doing anything, from communicating with a citizen, good Lord, from running an operation, from giving somebody information, from receiving any of that, phone calls, mailing a letter, making a phone call. You couldn't do any of those things with that surveillance around you because they weren't really after us. They wanted to find their own citizens who were giving us intelligence. They wanted to arrest those people. They wanted to give them a little short show trial, and they wanted to execute them as quickly as they could. And they did that over and over. Working for us in Moscow back then was a very dangerous proposition.
Sure. Sure. Jonna, I had a coach in high school who liked to talk about fishing, and one of his famous lines or advice was, first you have to get into the water. In your case, first you have to shake the tail. And that even for the briefest of moments, I mean, we're talking matters of seconds. And one of the fascinating things I learned, talk about the quick change. I think in the book, Tony refers to 45 seconds and 45 steps to completely change your appearance, your attire. Your gait. Amazing.
Yeah, we called it Disguise on the Run. It was a new kind of came out of Hollywood. It was a new illusion where you could be on the street, a crowded street. You needed the crowd. The crowd was part of your disguise. And you would have people following you, but they wouldn't be on your heels. They'd be back maybe 20, 30 feet. There'd be somebody across the street paralleling. And there was a methodology to this surveillance. Our goal was to break away from the surveillance, and we were always looking for new ways to do it. Disguise on the Run was the theory that you could change your clothes on the street in the middle of a crowd, and anybody moving past you is going to see this or that, but nobody's going to see you changing your clothes. So Tony demonstrated this for our office director back in Washington, and this was part of an enormous operation that was basically, we ended up listening to the communications of the Soviet nuclear facility outside of the city. This was the beginning of that. We had to get someone in a manhole. We had to get an American in a manhole in a place where an American shouldn't be seen. So Tony said, what if he leaves the embassy and he's dressed like a diplomat and he goes out to that big park, which is really crowded on the weekends, and when he walks through that park, he comes out the other side of the park looking different. So he shows our office director. Tony started out standing at the end of a long hall in a raincoat with a briefcase and a business suit. That's it. He took a couple of steps and he stopped and he took off his raincoat, but he peeled it off. So he turned it inside out, put it back on. It's actually now, it's a pink woman's coat. There's a big shawl attached to it. He takes a few more steps. He pulls the shawl up over his head. This gray wig kind of tumbles down. He takes a few more steps, reaches down, pulls up each of his pant legs. They catch on Velcro. He's got on black stockings. A couple more steps, he reaches down and removes a shoe cover from each shoe. He's now wearing black Mary Janes, black stockings, and a pink coat. This is my husband. Takes the shoes and puts them in his shirt. They become breasts. He takes a few more steps, reaches in a pocket, pulls out a mask. No hair attached to this, just the mask. Puts it over his face. Takes a few more steps, sets down his briefcase, pushes the button. And this was a piece from Hollywood. It was maybe one of the original Transformers. It turns into a grocery cart with groceries in it. And now he's walking up to the director of our office. And he's a little old lady, a Russian lady. And he said, that's kind of how it's going to work with our diplomat going into the manhole. And our office director said, that's brilliant. Go for it. You know, and that's the ploy that we used.
And I tell you,
and we
John,
got mad.
It's stories like that that are detailed in the Moscow Rules that almost made me, if it wasn't for your publicist's insistence, I would say this is a work of fiction. But this is amazing, wonderful stuff. John, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about how sometimes being a member of the CIA team means taking a hit for the team. And that might mean making dozens and dozens of visits to the local adult bookstore to buy blow-up dolls. We'll get more into that when we come back. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. There's your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're having just a heck of a chat with Jonna Mendez. She is the co-author. Her most recent book, she and her husband wrote, called The Moscow Rules. We're talking about some techniques and tools that helped the CIA win the Cold War with a specific focus on Moscow. Jonna, one of the things I loved in the book, the discoveries, was something I think you called the jack-in-the-box. And this was a tool that was used to buy just that few seconds of distraction, of deception from your tales there. But developing the actual piece of equipment, I kind of teased before the break, you first started off with something that existed, kind of a non-traditional tool, I would guess, for the CIA that was found at a local store there in Washington, maybe?
The idea for a jack-in-the-box was to be able to get the passenger out of a car and instantly replace him with someone who looked just like him, was always him. We needed about 8 seconds to do that. And we had a plan for how to get that 8 seconds. By taking two right turns in a row, you could count on having that time. The jack-in-the-box, the idea came when my husband was overseas with another officer. They were sitting somewhere having a beer. They had just had a moment. And he said, Tony said, we need some kind of a dummy to put in the car to replace the drivers. So they came up with this concept, and they sent they fired a missile at headquarters, is how they put it. They sent a cable back to headquarters in Langley saying, we need to get somebody doing some R&D on this. We need to come up with a device. Well, that went to the half of our office that was the engineering, the chemists, the physicists, those guys. And the ones that got this cable were sort of the mechanical engineering people who I want to be kind. They were sort of nerds. They were young. This would be not a difficult assignment. But what they needed to begin with was they needed the dummy. They needed the pop-up dummy, and they didn't know where to get one. So they went to Al's Magic Shop that used to be down by the White House. It was on 16th Street. And they were selling something called sex dolls, sex toys. They were inflatable dolls. And so our engineers, these two young men with their pens in their pockets and their high water pants and their, I don't know, they look like engineers. I think they bought a dozen of these dolls. And they came back to the office with them, and they said, don't ever send us down there again, because they couldn't figure, you know, if they couldn't make it work with six of them, they were not going back.
Did that go on a CIA credit card, Jenna, or I'm curious to see that expense report.
I don't know. I'd like to see the look on the guy's face who sold them the the 12 dolls.
Yeah. Well.
So anyway, they started out. They were inflating them with gas canisters, and they were putting the whole thing in a briefcase, and it worked. I mean, they would pop up, and we could put clothes on them and a head and wigs, and we could do that. We took them for a test drive, literally. Behind the Iron Curtain, one of the wives was trying one out to see how that would work. She pulled up the briefcase, put it on the car seat, hit the button. The thing popped up, and it exploded because the canister containing the gas was so cold that it came out, and it froze the plastic in the dolls, and then it just shattered like glass. So we had to start over. So we went to Hollywood, and we said, how would you do this? And they showed us, they just came up with this most elegant engineering mechanism where you had it there was no gas canister. It would just come up, and there it was in the car. I said, we could get rich selling these back in Washington for people in these HOV lanes, you know.
Right, right.
But these were very useful, and we used them a lot. And the first time we used one was in Moscow. It was built for Moscow. This was a proprietary tool. We used it nowhere but Moscow. No other station in the world even knew about it. This was a Moscow tool. First time we used it was the only way that we could meet with our most productive agent. We were worried. We hadn't heard from him. We thought we were going to lose the case. And it was out of desperation that we used it the first time. And it worked. But the first time we used it, it wasn't in a briefcase. It was in a birthday cake.
Amazing.
It was sitting. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Jenna, let's talk a little bit more about some of these, the gadgets, because, you know, some of the stuff, you know, I think back to, you're not as old as I am, but the old Dick Tracy comics, where Dick Tracy had a radio watch. And back then, sure, it was like, oh, my gosh, that's Buck Rogers stuff. That's the future. Now, everybody's carrying one on their wrist. And
yes,
a microprocessor and a computer, too. And some of these things, though, are older. The famous poison pen. Some of your, one of the things, that the L-pill, as I think you call it, I kind of suspected those actually did exist, but they were real, and some of your assets refused to work with you unless they were given one of these pills, correct?
That is correct. You know, my office was the queue of CIA. Those pills were held in my office in a lockbox that took two people, two keys at the same time to even open that box. They were so carefully guarded. And in my career, we only gave out two that I ever knew of. The one that we concealed in a pen, the man who was working for us, his name was Alexander Ogorodnik. His code name was Trigon. And he said, I'll work for you, but I want one of those. He said, the stories we hear about what they do when they catch one of us working for the West, one of the stories is that they feed us into a crematorium alive.
Oh,
he said, I want one of those pills. So he convinced us that he wasn't going to work, and we gave him the pill. We gave it to him, and it was in a pen. It was like one of those big, fancy, like a Mont Blanc pen. And we hollowed out the cap. And this was a glass ampoule that we put in that cap. But the cap was paper thin. And as it turned out, Trigon was arrested, and he was taken to Lubyanka. And they took everything from him, everything. And they even stripped him down to his skivvies. And they said, write your confession. And he said, I'll write it, but I want to write it. I want my pen. I want to write it with my pen. Evidently, back then, the Russian pens were notorious. They just didn't work. So they brought him his Mont Blanc pen, and he just bit down on the cap. And the Russian report says he was dead before he hit the floor. It was instant, which made all of us feel good because, I mean, compared to all the other terrible things that would be in store for him, that's what he wanted, and that's what he got. With the second agent that had insisted on a pen, and we reluctantly gave it to him, when he was arrested, he didn't have it. It was at home on his desk. And so he went through whatever they put him through before they shot him, before they executed him. So those pills were important in a couple of cases, but the same cases would often, we would issue them, a Mont Blanc pen, and it would have a camera in it. I was in charge of those cameras for a time. They were film cameras. They were very, very, very small. And then inside of the camera was a little bitty cassette. And inside of the cassette was the smallest piece of photographic film you would ever see. So you'd pick up a pen out there. You had to be careful. It was. It might just be a pen. It might be a pen with an L pill in it, or it could be a pen with a camera in it. You had to know where your equipment was, not use the wrong thing for the wrong reason.
Jonna, I'm thinking back now. You know, I used the Dick Tracy example. Now for the younger generation, film is almost a word they wouldn't recognize. Now with everything digitized, I'm guessing that has made your friends at the CIA's job easier or not necessarily?
Well, maybe easier, because actually manipulating that film, I mean, I had to develop that film, and then each picture, each 8.5 by 10 picture was the size of a dot on that film. You had to process it like any film. You had to print it. It was terribly, terribly meticulous. It was scary working with that film, because you knew people had risked their lives to deliver the film to you. And then it was a lot. It was a weighty load to carry when you were working with that film. But then I have to say that, I mean, it was the golden tool during the Cold War. The idea that a picture is worth 1,000 words couldn't be truer. We had spy satellites that were imaging the city of Moscow, and they could tell us what was going on, and, oh, look, they're putting in a new communications link here. We could see what was going on the ground, but those little tiny cameras could tell us what was going to happen in the future. So what we wanted from the cameras, we wanted the agendas for the meeting. We wanted the schematics for the new radar system. We wanted what Putin was thinking and saying and talking about. What's he going to do next? What's Kim Jong-un going to do next with his nuclear program? I trust that there is a version of my little camera still floating around out there, still collecting that kind of information on the plans and intentions of our enemies.
Jonna, would it be safe to say that no matter how far technology goes, the most important tool is still human intelligence? Is that living, breathing asset on the ground, in your opinion?
You know, you absolutely, you cannot do the work without people. Everyone thinks it's all digitized, and a lot of it is. But I'm turning to a page. Gina Haspel, who runs the CIA today, I have this always marked in whatever book is around me. She was quoted recently, and I put it in the book. She says, within the intelligence community, CIA is the keeper of the human intelligence mission. Technical forms of collection are vital, but a good human source is unique and can deliver decisive intelligence on our adversary's secrets and even on their intent. And that really sums it up. And if you've got human beings collecting the intelligence for you and taking the risk for you, you have to be able to meet with them. They're isolated in their own society. Typically, their families don't know what they're doing. Their families don't know the risk that they're taking. You have to meet with them. You have to look them in the eye and tell them, this is making a difference. This is going to our policymakers. We are factoring this into what we're doing. We are so proud of what you're, you know, you just have to meet them and stroke them. And there has to be a human connection.
Jonna,
there has to be.
When we come back, I want to talk about the flip side of that human connection, and some of the chapters in your book, The Moscow Rules, talk about some kind of dark times for the agency and some of the progress you had been making and then lost in Moscow. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Jonna Mendez. She is the co-author of a great new book called The Moscow Rules. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Jonna Mendez, the master of disguise for the Central Intelligence Agency. Jonna, we spent a lot of time talking about techniques and gadgets, and so just let me be clear here, Ben's dumb question of the show. So there's not somewhere in Switzerland a safe deposit box that if I go and open it up, it's full of passports and cash and a gun and maybe an L pill?
I hate to break your heart, but it's not going to be there.
Oh, no.
All of those things are so precious. Each one of them takes an enormous amount of work to create. We don't set them aside for contingency purposes. They are made one at a time with exquisite workmanship for a particular need.
Okay.
So Jason Bourne, he would open that box and it would be empty, and you know that would be the end of the show.
That'd be a bad day. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, it would.
Jono, one of the more discouraging, I guess it's the reality, but in your book, The Moscow Rules, we talked about human intelligence before the break, and the amount of damage you're building up these projects and these missions in Moscow. We're getting some great stuff from the assets that sometimes you recruited, but in many cases they came to you, and some of them tried multiple times to say, hey, I want to work for you, and it took some time to get them processed. But the damage done by folks like Edward Lee Howard and Aldrich Ames, and sort of the reverse side of that coin, and just how they pretty much gutted what we were doing in Moscow for a while, that's just the reality of the game, right? I guess
it is. When it happened, for instance, the Aldrich Ames case, the CIA had difficulty believing that one of our own could betray us like that. That happened more than once. You know, the CIA office was very much composed of men. And it was almost like a club. It's hard to get in. It's hard to qualify. It's hard to pass all of the tests. Once you get in, it is a very clubby atmosphere. And the thought that one of our own could be betraying us in that way was part of what made it so bad, because it basically, Aldrich Ames, it took two women in Soviet East European Division to find him. When the men sort of couldn't find him, the women could. You know, they had a kind of a different point of view. Jean Vertve and Sandy Grimes were the two women who put Aldrich Ames in jail for the rest of his life with 1 hour of sunlight a day for now till eternity. That's all he'll ever get. But he was selling, the way we looked at it was he was selling pounds of flesh for gold. He was giving away everyone he had ever worked with one at a time. And a lot of them he knew. And some of the last ones, because he really had to scratch his head to think, is there anyone else that I can betray? Surely there's someone else and I'll get a little bit more money. He knew these people and he knew what would happen to them. And he even went out to them when they were executing. We lost a lot of Asians over a summer. They disappeared, and then we heard, oh, they were caught. They were shot. He went out to them in a secret message and said, don't kill them so fast. He didn't say don't kill them. He said, don't kill them so fast, because it could lead back to me. Anyway, it was...
That's cold-blooded.
Those were dark days. They really were.
Jono,
and it can always happen, but that was just hard to handle.
In the close of your book, The Moscow Rules, you talk about how the game has changed. It's become much more of a contact sport. Am I wrong? And back in the good old days, if they caught one of theirs spying, they pretty much, it was the gulag or they were shot. That was the end of that discussion. But if they caught one of ours, maybe a brief stint at a police station and then they were expelled, or not in every case?
Yeah, they would be PNG, persona non grata. They would be very summarily and publicly and humiliatingly dismissed from the country, escorted to the airport, off we go. But, you know, if you notice, this book starts out in 2016, long after the, air quote, Cold War is over, with an embassy officer, a diplomat, let's just call him that, getting beaten to a bloody pulp in front of our own American embassy by a man who was clearly sent to do the beating, a KGB guy. They even ended up, that fight extended into the lobby of the American Embassy in Moscow, and it did not end. They broke the clavicles of the man who was being beaten. He was medevaced out the next day. This is during the Cold War. When the Cold War was over, this is still going on. This is when the presidential election was going on in 2016. So this heavy-handed thing that Putin is bringing to bear is something to keep an eye on. He is former KGB. There's nothing refined about him. He is not only intent on keeping his subjects from approaching any Americans and handing over any material, but he's going after people around the world who have relocated, who have defected, who have left the Soviet Union, and maybe they're living in London. And there are assassination attempts, and there are successful assassinations. And just, I think it was last week, they got another former Russian spy. They killed him in Angela Merkel's backyard, practically, in Berlin. And these things are done publicly. The Skripals in England, he was a former KGB officer. And the last thing I heard was about a Russian who was working. The reports said he worked for us for decades, and he was in Putin's inner circle. And he was providing us all kinds of information. And then the CIA, I don't know how, but they thought his name might be made public. And they pulled him out. This was fairly recent. They pulled him out and brought him back to America. We always promised them, if we can, we will rescue them. Well, we rescued this man and his family and resettled him. And somehow that got into the media. And so he was living somewhere here in Virginia, and they've just whisked him out of Virginia. I don't know where he is. I shouldn't know where he is. Well, but he will be on the run. He'll be on the run for the rest of his life from Putin.
Sure. Jonna, we've only got about a minute and a half left, and I tell you, I'm really enjoying this conversation. I encourage people to get and read the book, The Moscow Rules. It is fascinating and entertaining and easy read as well. Tell us a little bit about, you're a founding member of the Board of Advisors of the International Spy Museum. Is this someplace all of us can go and maybe see some of the things that you invented or used?
For anyone interested in the subject, the Spy Museum it's a one of a kind. There's only one museum devoted to this subject, and it is exquisite. There are so many exhibits. We've doubled the size. We started as a smaller museum and outgrew our space. We've got exhibits for kids, which are touchable things that they can play with, that they can interact with on every level. The museum it's an excellent, excellent place to visit.
Jonna, thank you so much for that. And no L pills in the kids exhibit, right?
No.
Okay. Just want to be clear about that. Again, folks, yes. Jonna, thank you so much for your time. We look forward to chatting with you again. Again, folks, the book is The Moscow Rules by Antonio and Jonna Mendez. Just a fascinating, fascinating read. If you wondered, well, we know that the Bourne identity was not accurate. We know that James Bond, maybe not so much, but there are some things in there. In fact, Jonna mentioned one film in particular that could have been used as a training video for some of the CIA agents. This has been your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. You can find this interview and over 200 others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio, at Twitter, at Warrior Radio TUC. And don't forget, if you support what we're doing, check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. For less than one cup of coffee a month, you can help us spread these important messages. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.